couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films A Star is Born and Venom, plus some retro reviews of the horror movies Return of the Vampire and The Funhouse and Retro Puppet Master. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Tales from the Hood 2. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is a big, exciting thing for me because the return of Mystery Science Theater 3000 is returning for a second season. And I guess it's like the 11th season or the 12th season, but it's the second season of the new revival, and that is dropping on Thanksgiving Day. Now, those of you who don't understand or even know much about Mystery Science Theater 3000, Turkey Day or Thanksgiving has a real value to it for Misties and fans of the show, because not only did the show premiere on Thanksgiving Day way, 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 way back in its KTMA UHF days, but it's also been a yearly tradition to do Turkey Day. They used to, during the run of the show, back when it was on Comedy Central, they'd put together 15 episodes of the show and they'd do 30 hours of Mystery Science Theater 3000 on Thanksgiving, Turkey Day, because turkeys are bad movies. And it was always a big thing. And I remember when I was watching that stuff in college, we would set up like a bank of VCRs because we didn't have cable back at home. And my sister and I would each have cable in our respective apartments. And we would just run a line of VCRs and tape like 6 episodes on each tape just so we can watch all the old episodes. And that's a huge deal for me. So I know what I'm going to be doing on Thanksgiving, not spending it with family. I'm going to be watching Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Return, again. A couple of things in development news that I think are interesting. The first one is James Wan's not going to be directing The Conjuring 3. And that's a big deal because James Wan sort of reinstituted the ghost story. He did a new version of horror movies with Insidious and The Conjuring, making them a little more pragmatic, making them more practical effects driven, not making them just jump scares or found footage. And it was a little more steady hand. And by the fact that he's not directing Conjuring 3, because he's doing stuff like Aquaman now, he's passing the reins on to somebody else. I just hope that whoever takes those reins puts as much care into the movies as he did and keeps it in the same flavor and vein, this more mature, a little more balanced presentation than just going into kitsch and trends, but set the trends rather than reacting to them. And I hope that that's what continues on with the franchise. Another piece of news is the Lilo and Stitch movie, the adorable film about Experiment 626 coming to Earth and then having a relationship with this little Hawaiian girl. That is getting a live action remake. And you know, I've been sort of quiet about these live-action remakes from Disney, because I love Disney, and I think Disney does some great stuff. But one thing Disney also will do is they will milk a franchise as long as they can until it dries up. And I'm worried that these live-action remakes will dry up fast. They did this back in the 90s, where they made live-action versions of their original films. The big one, obviously, everyone should remember would be 101 Dalmatians with Glenn Close as Cruella de Vil. And those have a limited shelf life. There's a kitsch to them. You know, they did the live action, well, I wouldn't even call it live action because it was mostly CGI animals, was the Jungle Book. I mean, you had a real life live action human Mowgli, but that's about it. And they're doing The Lion King, Jon Favreau's directing that. And you've also got Beauty and the Beast that came out. That was a huge hit. I didn't think it was as good as the original, but it did very, very well. But these movies making like $1 billion aren't going to last. And I'm wondering when they're going to stop mining them. And I guess what's going to happen is we're going to see stuff like they're doing The Little Mermaid, they're doing Dumbo, and eventually people will get tired of it. And then they're going to be making tons and tons of money until they won't. And Lilo and Stitch, I think that could be a great little movie. That could also be an absolute disaster if they don't do it right. It all depends on who it's in the hands of. As we learned with the DC movies, you put them in the hands of Zack Snyder and then you put everything in the hands of Zack Snyder, and you get movies that kind of all look the same. Whereas, like, the Marvel movies, you have a steady hand. Even the Star Wars movies are having trouble trying to figure out how much they can diversify and how many movies they can release in the course of a calendar year. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two Christmas releases I want to talk about really quickly. The first one is Holmes and Watson, which opens on December 21st.
Sherlock Holmes. His methods are ingenious.
Right there.
He's a master of disguise.
What have you done with Sherlock?
Why, Watson?
I never left.
Oh, amazing.
And his mind is brilliant. Solve this case in 4 days or I will kill the Queen. Signed, Professor James Moriarty.
Come, Watson. We have a killer to catch.
This, of course, stars Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, who, of course, did movies like Step Brothers and Talladega Nights together. They're very, very funny. I like both of them. I used to watch Will Ferrell back in, gosh, was it my college days? And I think he's one of those rare actors that can do serious and comedy. And for the same token, that goes the same for John C. Reilly. I mean, he can do very serious roles. He can also do very goofy, over-the-top things. I mean, one of the first things I remember seeing him in was Boogie Nights. So I like both of them as actors, and I think that they're funny. This movie, though, feels like it should have been made about 10 years ago. It feels like it's a response to the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes, and they just finally got around to making it. It feels out of time and out of place. I mean, even if it would have been made 5 years ago, like when the BBC was redoing Sherlock and they had Elementary on CBS starting, it just feels like this is so after the fact. At least the trailer does, and it looks goofy. It could be funny. It's always hard to tell on a trailer for a comedy because you can cram in all the funny jokes into a two-minute trailer, and then the rest are terrible. But on the same token, you can also get a movie that doesn't play well as a trailer because you can't put the best jokes in there because they're crass or they're long-form jokes or they won't fit as a one-liner. So, like, Superbad was a great example of a movie that was very, very funny, but it didn't play well as a trailer. The December 21st release date is kind of odd for me. This doesn't feel like a Christmas movie. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. The next one I want to talk about is Vice, which opens on Christmas Day.
I want you to be my VP. I want you. You're my vice.
Vice presidency is a mostly symbolic job. However, if we came to a different understanding, I can handle the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, military, energy, and foreign policy.
I like that.
Obviously, this is about Dick Cheney as the vice president, and it's directed by Adam McKay, who did movies like Anchorman. So it's got a lot of people from that cast. It has Steve Carell plays Donald Rumsfeld, I think. You've got Sam Rockwell, which is an interesting turn for him playing George W. Bush. But it's mainly about Dick Cheney and how he was involved in the White House and how his vice presidency was a little bit more than your average vice presidency. I don't know how much of this is speculation. I don't know how much of this is coming from like memoirs or leaked stories or partisan sides. It's clearly coming from an angle. It looks like it's going to be the most notable thing is Christian Bale's performance of Dick Cheney, which is a transformative performance. You don't even recognize Christian Bale in the shots in the trailer. I mean, this reminds me of the level of falling into a character that you had with Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill last year in The Darkest Hour. So that's, I think, where you're going to see most of the buzz from this outside of just, you know, partisan political venting. It's going to be that transformative performance by Christian Bale. I'm already predicting this is going to have Oscar written on it simply for that. It could be a terrible movie, but for that reason alone, just his portrayal and his look, I think might make a difference. Anyways, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the old horror movies, Return of the Vampire and The Funhouse.
They did the mash.
They did the
the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to jump into the movie reviews and do the stuff I love doing at Halloween, and that is talk about horror movies. I know if I'm bugging people. I'll stop talking about horror movies. I'll start talking about bad movies in November because they're turkeys. I'll start talking about Christmas movies at Christmas time. And then I'll be, of course, talking about award movies at the beginning of the year. So I have different things that happen throughout the year. So it's not always going to be horror movies, but I love to just dive in at Halloween time. As some people know, I like to watch a horror movie a day around Halloween. And a lot of times it's old standbys. Like I watched The Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978 with my son, who's 10, who'd never seen it before. And I lost sleep over that movie when I was 10. I think he handled it a little differently than I did, but he kind of got sucked in. It was funny watching him. He was into that movie. That is a great movie. It's one of my favorite of all times. And it's the best version of it, I think. I love the original with Kevin McCarthy, but the one in 1978 with Donald Sutherland and Brooke Adams is so visceral and pragmatic and realistic, and it tops the other remakes that they did. Like in 1993, they did one with Gabrielle Anwar, and they did a remake in 2007, I think, with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig. That one's kind of a mess. 1978's a really good one. But the other thing I do with my kids every year, and this goes back to me when I was in high school, there was a theater in town called the Drexel North, and it was this big 800-seat theater that is now a fitness center, which is sad in its own right. But it was this big 800-seat theater, and they'd do 24-hour marathons where they'd show 12 or 13 horror movies all night long, and they'd have trailers and cartoons and short films and little bits and theater bumpers. That always made it very special of an experience. Now, I was in high school in the 80s, so that was your only option to see some of these movies. Yes, you had VHS, but you were also looking at it on a 19-inch TV in your parents' basement, and you weren't watching them on the big screen. So I would go to these all-night movie marathons, and I loved it. It was a huge deal for me in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, they still do them because of scheduling and some other things happening in my life. I'm not able to go to them all the time. But it's a little easier to do them at home, you know, because we have better TVs, we have Blu-ray, and what I also do is I do a mini marathon now every year for my family of horror movies. It used to be 24 hours, but I just don't have the strength for that anymore. I do like a 12 or 13 hour or 14 hour horror movie marathon. And, you know, I had like my dad come over and my kids were there and my wife was doing concessions, and I put together trailer blocks and we watch cartoons like Looney Tunes. And so it's a lot of fun, and I make it as much like a theatrical experience as possible. This year, two of the movies that we watched, I wanted to review on this show, and I might drop a couple in later on because they're classics. And one of the things that I've done as a parent and a movie lover is I have made a point to expose my kids not just to the movies that are out there in the theaters right now. Those are great. You know, I love taking my kids to the Marvel movies and the Star Wars movies and all that good stuff. But I also like them to see older films. And I'm not just talking about nostalgic 80s stuff that I saw when I was a kid, or like I mentioned, I watched Invasion of the Body Snatchers 1978 version with my son the other day. Those were stuff that I saw as a kid, but even older ones. I like to, during these marathons, I pick stuff out of the different eras. I like showing them the old monster movies from the 40s. I think it's worth something cinematically to expose children to the black and white movies, the movies that were made long before digital technology, long before any sort of modern filmmaking technique, stuff that was made long before I was even alive, like The Wolfman and Frankenstein and Dracula. Those are worth showing, and not just in the horror genre. I mean, it's worth showing them stuff like Citizen Kane and classic movies, because not everything has happened in your lifetime, and you need to have a sense of history, not just for history and of the world and the country and of people, but of cinema. One of them that we did this weekend was Return of the Vampire. Bela Lugosi stars as a vampire who rises from a London grave during the bombing of World War II.
Tonight, I will take Nikki away. Her soul will wander through the night, and you will never find where her body rests.
Nikki, come to me.
That wasn't a man. That was a wolf.
This is considered sort of an unofficial sequel to Dracula. It was made by Columbia Pictures. Universal, of course, did Dracula. They held the rights. So Columbia couldn't do another Dracula movie. And Bela Lugosi only played Dracula twice in his entire lifetime. He played him in Dracula, and then he played him in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. He played vampires, though. Like I said, it's an unofficial sequel to Dracula. Of course, Dracula's daughter and then Son of Dracula were both there. And while Bela Lugosi showed up in all these other Universal horror movies, like The Wolfman, he played Bela the Gypsy, and he played Igor in the Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman or Ghost of Frankenstein. He played various characters. But this is a fun little, it's very much cut from the same cloth of Dracula, only it's, you know, like about, I think, 12 years later was when they made it. It's classic Lugosi. It's got the classic elements to it, the graveyards, the bats. You've got a werewolf in there who talks plain English, which is kind of silly. But they have all these elements, and you have the police detective who doesn't believe any of it. This is a fun movie. It's worth tracking down, especially if you have shown, you know, a younger generation the original Dracula and taught them to appreciate watching a black and white movie that's not going to spoon feed them special effects and action from end to end, and to enjoy the atmosphere. Now, this isn't as atmospheric as the 1931 version. The 1931 Dracula is very atmospheric, and the set design is all built for the Academy frame, and it's very intricate and intense. This one's a little more mainstream for the time. This was around the time they were making The Wolfman and Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, as opposed to just coming out of the silent era in 1931 when the original Dracula was. But still, this is worth checking out. It's a sort of a lost favorite with Bela Lugosi. Return of the Vampire rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I just have a couple, you know, like a minute to talk really quickly about The Fun House, and that's all I really need. Directed by Tobe Hooper, made in 1981, a group of teenagers go into a carnival and hide overnight in the funhouse, only to be stalked by a mutant killer.
Something is alive in the funhouse. Something not alive like its father. Something better dead. Something that has the form of a human, but not the face.
This better be good.
It's gonna be great.
Something that feeds off the flesh and blood of young innocents.
Here we go, this is it.
Something that tonight will turn the funhouse into a carnival of terror.
This is very similar to Hellfest, which is out right now. This is just a slasher. It's not a particularly good slasher. It has some great imagery to it, and it has a great box cover. It had always had a great VHS box cover. But in essence, it's a bunch of teens going into a bad situation and being stalked by a killer. Not much more. It takes a long time to get to the slasher part of this slasher. And other than that, the characters aren't terribly memorable. They're not terribly well developed. This is exactly the kind of movie that came out in the early 80s that was trying to play off of all the success of Friday the 13th and the Halloween movies. So it's sort of one of those things I have never seen, I've wanted to see. But I have to say, it didn't really grab me as a horror movie. Even as a retro horror movie, somebody who loved the 80s and grew up in the 80s, this one really is somewhat forgettable. So I'm going to have to say The Funhouse kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the new movies in theaters, A Star is Born and Venom.
Happy, happy Halloween, 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 happy, happy.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the new movie reviews with A Star is Born. Bradley Cooper makes his directorial debut in this remake about a self-destructive music star who falls in love with a young ingenue whose career is on the rise.
I always knew, like, you were gonna do something. That you'd be all right. It's the first time I'm worried about you.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Okay.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they liked the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
Of the four versions of A Star is Born, I've only seen two of them. I've seen the movie with James Mason and Judy Garland from the 50s. I've not seen the Barbra Streisand movie from the 70s, and I've never seen the original. But here's the thing with this movie. This movie feels like it's treading familiar ground. Not just because it's the fourth movie of A Star Is Born, it's like the 400th movie of self-destructive music stars. It doesn't matter whether it's a biopic like Walk the Line or Ray, or a fictional piece like A Star Is Born, these movies tend to follow the same trajectory. I was telling my mom I went to go see this, and I said I refer to it as a bingo movie. It's the kind of movie where I feel like I have a card, and I got to go, okay, music star going down in his career, check. Alcoholism, check. Drug abuse on the set, check. Somebody getting so mad they're ripping things off the wall, check out bingo! And you get all the stuff that you need, that's things you're supposed to have in a movie like this. It is not my cup of tea. I'm going to just say that right now. I know, I am fully aware that this was like the greatest movie that ever came out at Toronto and Telluride, and it's getting the greatest buzz ever. And people are already saying, just don't release any more movies this year. This is best picture, period. I know people are saying that. I disagree. This is not the first time that I am not agreeing with a lot of my critical brethren. And that's okay. That's what's great about movies, is everybody can have a different opinion. Now, with that said, it is an impeccably made movie. It is very well done from a filmmaking standpoint. The directing's very good. Bradley Cooper does a good job. I don't know how much of it is him doing a good job or if he's having his hand held, because that happens a lot. When a star, as an actor, when they do their first movie as a director, sometimes, yeah, they're directing, but they're getting a lot of help. And sometimes there are actors who can do both. You know, Mel Gibson is a fantastic director. I know he's an anti-Semite, but he's a fantastic director. Clint Eastwood is a good actor, but he's also a great director. And they're definitely doing their own thing. I still need to see a couple more Bradley Cooper movies that he's directed before I can fully say that this is authentically him alone doing this. But it's well directed. The music's very good. The songs are performed very well, including Bradley Cooper doing his own performances. Of course, Lady Gaga's good. She's fantastic. She's an incredibly talented woman. I love the fact that you're getting to kind of see a raw version of her. You know, she is so known for the kitsch and the costumes and the wacky moments that you forget she's an incredibly talented woman who has a great voice. And she does a great job in the movie. The acting is quite good. He's good. She's good. You've got Sam Elliott in there. He's good. You know, it's from a filmmaking standpoint, it's very well done. It just has no interest to me whatsoever. And I've seen some angst from some of my critical brethren out there who complain about people saying, oh, how dare you say that it's not your interest? Well, it's not just about your interest. It's about how the movie's made and how it's told. I'm like, no, you got to have an interest in the movie. If you have an interest in that, if you want to watch self-destructive musicians ruin their lives on the big screen, you can turn on the TV and watch the news, or you can go see this movie. In a lot of ways, it's just misery porn to me, though. It's just gut-wrenching to be gut-wrenching. It's to just wring out as much emotion and angst and pain out of the viewer as possible. I am not into that. And if you're not into that, it's going to be a terrible movie. If you are into it, it's going to be fantastic. And I'm not going to stand in your way from seeing it. But I'm here to say, no, let's pump the brakes on this one. First of all, it's not for everybody. Second of all, it is okay to not like this movie. It is also okay to have no interest in seeing it and then not see it. Yes, the performances are good, but if you're not interested in seeing the movie, don't see the movie. I had to, and I don't consider it the best of the year. Sorry, I'm going against the grain on this one, and I will probably be repeating myself for the next several months as we roll into award season. But I have to say that A Star Is Born kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Venom. Tom Hardy stars as an investigative journalist who bonds with an alien parasite that gives him superpowers.
We found something. We call them symbiotes. Carlton Drake believes that the union between human and symbiote is the key to our evolution.
I'm feeling really sick. I'm hearing a voice.
Eddie.
If you're gonna stay, you will only hurt bad people.
The way I see it, we can do whatever we want.
The first time we saw Venom on the big screen was in Spider-Man 3, 11 years ago. It was not particularly done well. The version of Venom that you saw in Spider-Man 3 was not the version of Venom that you saw in the comic books. I never read the comic books. I've just heard plenty of fans of the comic books complain about that. And so when they got a new Venom movie, they're giving a standalone Venom movie, there was a lot of excitement in the geek world. And to their credit, they get their own Venom movie. It is Venom and other alien parasites, but it's basically Venom. Tom Hardy's very good in this movie. You can actually hear what he says. His face isn't covered when he's talking, like in Mad Max or The Dark Knight Rises or Dunkirk. He does fine in the movie. In fact, I think he elevates the movie way more than it really should be. The story is really uneven. It's got the billionaire trying to colonize other planets. It's got this weird environmental message, but this anti-billionaire message. It's got like things happening in here, like story construction moments where you're like, well, I don't even understand how that pragmatically happens. You know, they're stealing homeless people and running experiments on them and then making them disappear, but somehow they're stealing them and having them sign waivers, but then they just dump them in landfills to get rid of. It's the strangest setup of a movie that I've seen that takes so much time to explain the nuance of what they're doing with it making no sense. Also, the acting, Tom Hardy's good. Everyone else is terrible. Michelle Williams is in the movie. She plays his girlfriend or his ex-girlfriend, and she's awful in this movie. And I'm not a huge fan of Michelle Williams, but I've seen her in movies, and there are times when I think she's done quite well. I thought she was one of the best things in Brokeback Mountain. I thought she was the best performance in that one. I thought she was a fantastic performance in Manchester by the Sea. The ones that she gets a lot of accolades for, stuff like My Week with Marilyn, I'm like, that one was dumb. I didn't like her in that. So she kind of blows hot and cold, but boy, she blows really cold on this one. She is terrible in this movie. The other thing with the movie is it's very uneven. It feels like it was shot to be R-rated. And I think they were going for that. They're going for a violent, gritty, something that could stand up with Logan or Deadpool. But then they decided to make it PG-13, and so it seems very cobbled. The editing is really clunky, especially in the action sequences. Like a point where Venom like kills somebody and then they leave and then you don't see any remains. You don't even see a splatter and you're like, well, that doesn't even make any sense. So it feels like they really sanitized it in a lot of ways. And then on top of it, they put this comedy in there. They put this sort of slapsticky, goofy moments that do not work in as dark of a movie as this is. And they really are jarring. It's almost like they said, add more comedy. We need this to be funny because it's a comic book movie. In that way, it feels like it was made at like the turn of the century. This feels more in line with something like Spawn or the movie Daredevil with Ben Affleck or Ghost Rider with Nicolas Cage. All that stuff that came out before the summer of 2008 when The Dark Knight and Iron Man totally changed the field. That stepped things up. That was when Marvel Studios started making their movies, and that's when The Dark Knight really said, hey, this is what superhero movies could be. But otherwise, it's really uneven. I'm going to have to say that Venom kind of sucks as well.
It kind of sucks.
Okay. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Retro Puppet Master, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Tales from the Hood 2.
Spider-Man. Does whatever a spider can, spins a web.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews. I'm going to do another retro review, literally a retro review, because the movie's called Retro Puppet Master. It is not based on Robert Heinlein's The Puppet Masters. This Puppet Master has nothing to do with it. The reason I'm talking about this one, it's a bizarre, random movie. But like I said, I like to watch a horror movie a day, and this week I watched Retro Puppet Master. And part of the reason I watched it is because it was on Amazon Prime, and it was done by Riff Trax. Now, if you don't know what Riff Trax is, they're the guys from Mystery Science Theater 3000, the second generation. You've got Michael J. Nelson, you've got Bill Corbett, who played Brain Guy and Crow, and then, of course, Kevin Murphy, who's been with it forever, playing Tom Servo. And they riff the movie. They do a commentary track, and it can make terrible movies kind of funny. The other reason I picked this is because it stars somebody from one of the worst movies ever made, Greg Sestero, who's known for being in The Room. And he, of course, wrote the book The Disaster Artist, which was made into a movie last year with James Franco, which was one of my favorite movies of the year. So I thought it was interesting to sort of see this bizarre piece of cinema history from the direct-to-video shelves. And in Retro Puppet Master, The Room's Greg Sestero stars as a young André Toulon, a French puppeteer who creates a group of disturbing puppets that are brought to life.
For those who think they've seen it all, now, see how it all began.
Let's begin. It cannot be saved, but the secret must be saved. You can make your puppets truly live. And there is little time, shall we begin?
I'll be honest, when I first picked this, I thought it was just a renamed version of the original Puppet Master. It wasn't. The Puppet Master series is from Full Moon, and I have always had a lot of respect for Full Moon. They were a direct-to-video series. Charles Band had been making movies in the 80s. He was actually involved in stuff like Reanimator, which is a fantastic film, and Dolls, and Troll. Then eventually, he developed the Full Moon brand, which was big in the late 80s and through the 90s, which was a direct-to-video company. They just released everything on VHS. Nothing ever got a theatrical release. I mean, like Dolls originally did, like his first earlier films, but when he was doing the Full Moon stuff, they were stuff that he just cranked out. And there was a certain amount of kitsch to him. He did these things called Subspecies, which had these vampires from Romania, and he did the Puppet Master, which were these dolls that came to life, and of course he did Doll Man, which that starred Tim Thomerson as a cop who had gotten shrunken down in size. They did a lot of these movies, and they were all like shot in Romania, and they were super on the cheap, but they were actually kind of fun. When they got to about the fifth or sixth installment of the franchise, they were really kind of circling the drain. So anyways, this one is, it's a terrible movie. It stars Greg Sestero. Of course, it's going to be a terrible movie. It's actually kind of hard to follow at times. It still feels like a Full Moon movie, but it feels like one of those Full Moon movies that has been made after the Full Moon heyday. And Full Moon, like I said, I was a huge fan when I was younger. But this one still doesn't even reach the level. It feels like, you remember, it's like the Hellraiser movies. The first Hellraiser movie is fantastic, and that was in the theaters. The second one I also think is fantastic. I've always loved the second Hellraiser as much, if not more, than the first. I thought that took it in new places. Then they did the third one, and then they started going direct to video, and then they did the one, there's one that it stars like Adam Scott from Parks and Rec, and it takes place in space and also in the 17th century and stuff. That's what this feels like, it with the lower budget. It rips off shots, like almost direct shots and visual elements from better movies like Dark City. I actually paused at one point and showed my kids. I said, look at this shot from Dark City and this shot from this movie. They're just ripping it straight off. Like I said, it was at a point where they were just kind of circling the drain with the Puppet Master movies, and they were just still trying to survive on this one. So the riff tracks was funny. Mike, Bill, and Kevin did a great job goofing on the movie, and that's the only way you should watch this, because otherwise it is terrible. So it's available on Amazon Prime in the Riff Tracks version, which is worth watching only for making it funny. But otherwise, Retro Puppet Master totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. Last weekend, it was kind of a big surprise. I think a lot of people were expecting Smallfoot to do better, because it's a kid's movie, and that tends to do well at this time of year. But Night School came in with $27 million, which was kind of high on the expectations. They were expecting it to be a little bit less. But that's really good for a movie that only costs about that much to make. And then Smallfoot came in with $23 million, which is respectable. They weren't expecting this one to be like Pixar level. And it's a cute movie, and it should have some legs going through, because I think its only competition is the Goosebumps movie that comes out next week. But even then, that Goosebumps movie, I think that skews to a different demographic. Hellfest only came in at number 6. It had about $5 million. But again, that's how much the movie cost to make. So that's why these movies can be profitable, and that's following the slasher business model from the 80s. Although this week should be pretty big. Both Star is Born and Venom are going to be big movies. I think Venom is going to be bigger than the Star is Born simply because, you know, it has a bigger box office potential. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is on Tales from the Hood 2. Keith David steps in as Sims, an undertaker who tells moralistic horror tales to an AI computer designed to be a police and military robot.
No one tells stories as well as I.
I think it's going to be quite amazing.
On Blu-ray, DVD, and digital October 2nd.
Man, the setup of this movie is so different than Tales from the Hood. I remember seeing the original Tales from the Hood back in the 90s. I watched it on HBO or on VHS at some point, and I thought it was okay. I got it about a year and a half ago to review on Blu-ray. They had a collector's edition Blu-ray. And I actually thought it held up as a film better than I thought it worked back in the 90s. It's very heavy-handed. It's not a subtle movie. But the original Tales from the Hood actually is, you know, it's kind of an interesting film. It tells these moralistic tales, and it's clunky with them, but it also has some really interesting moments, and it does deal, it's a social commentary movie as much as it is a horror movie, and so it tells different tales dealing with social issues, whether it's racial issues or domestic violence. Rusty Cundiff, who directed and starred in that movie, also directs this one along with Darren Scott. And it's got some of the same people involved. Spike Lee's involved in producing it. You've got Keith David taking over the role that was played by Clarence Williams in the original movie. I'm not exactly sure why Clarence Williams didn't return. You know, he might be just getting too old. I mean, he, you know, it is 20 years since then, and he's in his late 70s. So Keith David's fun. He chews the scenery. The wraparound story is really bonkers. I mean, it's really heavy-handed, and it's the problem with this movie, as opposed to Tales from the Hood, is Tales from the Hood 2, there is no subtlety whatsoever. There's a certain subtlety and sort of a containment of the first movie. This one just goes off the deep end, and like two of the stories are very on the nose and goofy at the same time. There's one about this sort of like this pretty white girl wanting to get these gollywog racist dolls from a museum. And then of course it turns into a big doll and kills her, but it's weird looking. It's just, it's not scary. It's, you know, you can take something that looks cute and clever and make it horrifying, or you can fail at that and make it just silly. And that's what happens in this movie. And then there's one story that's told that's kind of has some interesting elements to it in terms of talking about the civil rights movement and how that started, but it's so spoon feeding everything to you. And then even when it works out, how the ending works, it doesn't even make sense. And even if I'm watching this movie, it's about this, the wraparound's about this weapons dealer who's making this basically a RoboCop, and he's having this undertaker come in and tell its story so it can develop a moral high ground. That makes no sense. The premise of it is just so hard to swallow, and it just gets silly. It's not nearly as well put together and well constructed as the first film, and the first film was already kind of shaky anyways. So I'm going to have to say Tales from the Hood 2 totally sucks.
It sucks.
The other new movies that are out on DVD and Blu-ray this week include The First Purge and Sicario, Day of the Soldado, and that is it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about First Man, Goosebumps 2, and Bad Times at the El Royale. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.